the most wonderful time of the year.
12:17
with the kids.
Dean Richards Sunday morning on WGN. Time for our pre-Christmas food time show. Chicago Radio's original cooking and dining show. And the Sunday before Christmas, we always spend a little bit of time talking about some holiday baking on our food show, which, by the way, this week is sponsored by our friends at the Greek Islands Restaurant. Joining me to talk some holiday baking is our friend, Chef John Abels. Chef, good morning and welcome. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Dean. Pleasure to be here.
Welcome back. So do you just go crazy baking this time of year?
I do. Dozens and dozens and dozens of cookies.
It's the baconest time of year. If it's not the cookies, which probably are the most common things, it's gingerbread houses, fruitcakes. Is anyone making fruitcakes?
Fruitcakes
from scratch anymore?
It's kind of a popular thing. I do an Italian version. And then we do a pandoro, which is a beautiful golden butter bread. Delicious.
Is that the sort of the like super tall kind of cake that you see in stores?
Yes, yes.
So if someone wanted to do, is fruitcake difficult to do, or is that fairly simple?
It's fairly simple. You just want to soak your fruits in, your favorite type of brandy or rum, what have you, and just putting together a normal yeast dough. The yeast dough is probably the hardest part of it, but because it just takes a little bit of patience.
Because it's a little more dense, you mean?
Yes.
So how would you go ahead and do that? Walk me through some of the details on these things.
Sure. So what I would normally do with the fruit is just pick your favorite dried fruits. It can be apricots, figs, cranberries, what have you. And you want to soak those in either a sugar syrup or an alcohol with sugar syrup.
For how long are you soaking?
Oh, a good 24 to 48 hours ahead of time.
Okay.
Just to get them nice and plump again. And then you would scale out the rest of your ingredients, flour, butter, sugar, eggs, yeast, and mix that together. You want the yeast to activate, so you're going to have to give that just a little bit of time. And then when you're ready...
I don't know anything about baking, so I need details on all these things. When you say to activate it, what does that mean exactly?
Oh, sure.
That sounds like a Star Wars term. We're going to activate the planet Alderaan.
No, we're going to activate the yeast by adding hot water to it.
Okay.
And then sugar. Yeast feeds on sugar, so it needs to start to activate, and the yeast needs to start growing again. So it needs the carbohydrates from the sugar in order to do that. So when it mixes with the proteins in the flour, then you have an actual baked good.
So that means it's going to have to rest for a little while, I guess.
Yes.
Take the time to activate, which is about how long?
Oh, a good hour and a half.
Oh, okay.
Just to let that happen.
All right. So once that happens, then what?
Then we add the remainder of our flour, the rest of our baking soda, and the dried fruits. And folding that all together very gently. You don't want to overmix. You don't want to overbeat. Line that into a lined pan, a greased pan. Depending upon what shape you want, you can put it in a bundt pan if you have, or if you have a little bit more decorative bundt pan, or even just in a straight loaf pan.
Okay.
Depending on what shape you want with your
right.
finished fruitcake.
Okay.
And you're going to bake that at 375 degrees for about 45 minutes until it is nice and beautiful golden brown.
Okay.
And then you're going to take that out of the oven, let it rest. And some of that remaining syrup that's left over from the macerated fruits, you're going to pour that over while it's still a little warm so that it soaks down in there.
And just let it soak on in there.
Yes.
Does that give it a special preservative kind of quality that, fruitcakes have, taken a bum rap over the years of,
right.
Being, like you one fruitcake that gets passed around for decades. Because of its long-lasting quality. That's not really true of regular fruitcakes, right?
No, that's not really true at all, especially when you fresh bake it. I think people just did that because nobody really wanted to slice into the actual fruitcake itself because it's so dense and it's so, I don't know what the term is, threatening looking. Like it could give you a heart condition in a minute.
Yeah, it's so delicious, though. I mean, fruitcake that's done well is just nothing but delicious, so... So a good idea. Let's talk cookies, though. And by the way, I want to open up our phone lines. This is traditionally one of our most popular, food time segments, the annual baking segment with people with questions about baking, problems that they may be having that you can help them solve their problems 312-981-7200 is our phone number to answer any of your baking questions, any, you know, cookies or otherwise, any kind of baking questions. Chef John is here to answer the call. What do you think is the most common kind of a Christmas cookie? Sugar cookie, you think?
A sugar cookie or the little Mexican wedding bells. Those are really simple. You'd nice, typical nutmeg, cinnamon, ginger flavors for this time of the year. And you just roll it in powdered sugar. Delicious.
Okay, so let's walk through both of those, you know, with a little bit of detail on both.
So butter cookies, you can make a shortbread if you want, or you can just make a standard butter cookie. And it simply is just sugar, butter. You're going to take that in a stand mixer, or if you have a hand mixer, it's entirely up to you, but you want to beat your sugar and butter together so that it is creamed, so that the sugar is more suspended inside inside the butter. And then from there, you're going to add egg, vanilla, and then just to put that back on low speed to just to mix the egg into the product, and then you're going to want to take some flour and a little touch of baking soda just to help the cookie rise just a little bit.
Okay.
And blend that in just until mixed. Again, it's really, really important that you don't start to beat the gluten out of the flour. You want the flour and butter and egg to react to one another while it's in the oven.
Okay. All right.
And then you shape those into your favorite shapes. If you've got some great cookie cutters, or if you, you know, just want to cut out rounds and then for the kids to decorate a little bit later, you can do that simply. And then for that particular cookie, I don't bake that at such a high temperature. I bake that at 350 degrees until they're lightly golden brown around the edges, puffed up just a little bit. And then I allow them to rest on the pan once I take them out of the oven. That's a 12 to 15 minute cookie at the most.
Okay, so you leave them in the pan and don't put them on a rack?
I don't put them on the rack immediately because I want the bottom to finish cooking just a little bit, and the cooking will carry over just a tad bit out of the oven. I usually leave it on the pan for 2 to 5 minutes, just depending, and then I transfer to a wire cooking rack, or cooling rack, sorry.
I imagine that adds to what you really want in a cookie, a nice crispy outer edge, but, you know, like something, you know, soft and delicious in the middle.
Exactly. That's the trick.
Very good. Barb was on the phone line asking the question, can you use vanilla concentrate to replace vanilla extract? What's the difference between the two, John?
So vanilla concentrate is going to be much, much more powerful than vanilla extract. Vanilla extract has been extracted from the vanilla bean with alcohol. The vanilla concentrate, you're going to want to use very, very little of it to add flavor to the cookie or to whatever you're using. It's just a little bit more... it's so concentrated that you don't want to use too much of it. I'm talking like the tip of a knife worth would give.
Okay.
Oh wow, it's that powerful, huh?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Oh, good to know.
So I know, Barb, if you take a little drop of that behind each ear.
Yeah, you never know, right?
Va 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 voom is all I'm saying.
Well, thank you so very much. Have a Merry Christmas.
You do the same. Thank you very much. Here's Barbara. You're on WGN with Chef John.
Yes, good morning. I just have one question. Why, if I make the same chocolate chip cookie recipe all the time, sometimes my cookies turn out, you know, with a nice domed appearance, you know, kind of a rocky-looking homemade look, and other times they're just very flat?
It depends on the temperature, really, of your butter. If your butter is at room temperature at 75 degrees, or if it's at room temperature of 50 degrees, it's going to make a total difference. Most butter is made with the addition of a little bit of water, so you want to be careful of the actual temperature of the room. Like closer to 65, 70 is a better room temperature, and oftentimes when you're doing so much holiday baking, the kitchen's going to be the hottest place to be. So you want to keep that, I bring my butter up to room temperature next to the window in the kitchen. It's always a little bit cooler there.
So ideally 65 degrees.
About 65 degrees is a great ideal temperature, yes.
You think that's been a difference in your baking, Barb, of the temperature of your butter?
Well, you know, I always just take it out and I leave it to room temperature. I don't ever take the temperature of my butter.
Sure.
But I wait until it gets somewhat soft. But after I mix up the dough, I put it, because it's softer, and I think that's the reason, I put the whole bowl of dough back in the refrigerator so it hardens up a little bit, and then I take it out and put it on the cookie sheet, and I'm thinking that would help me sometimes.
It does. Absolutely. Letting your dough rest and letting the butter chill just a little bit back. But it does make it – I'll be very, very honest with you. I was making green tea shortbread cookies the other day, and I left my temperature out – or my butter out to room temperature, and it was about 85 in the kitchen that I was working in. So it did not come out. They came out like lace cookies. Shortbread's pretty mm-hmm. dense. Yeah, when I went to cut them and place them on my silicone mat, they just went – they went flat, and they looked like they were little bubble cookies. But it definitely makes a difference, the temperature of the butter before you started mixing the dough.
It's a little bit cooler. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I hope that helps
you
out.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas to you, Barb. Thanks very much. John, you hang in for a second. We're going to update news next and then get right back to more calls. If you have some questions about your baking, 312-981-7200. It's all coming up. Talking some holiday baking today on our Food Time Show with Chef John Abel joining us today, answering your questions at 312-981-7200. John, what are some of the must-have baking equipment for the average home? I know in a professional kitchen, you know, it's different, but what kind of pans? I know that makes a difference. What kind of utensils? What are the must-have things for a baker in their home?
Sure. No, I'm a firm believer that every home should have a stand mixer, whether it be a KitchenAid or another brand. It's the easiest, most workhorse tool in the kitchen, especially if you love to bake. Outside of that, some rubber spatulas. I use high heat spatulas. So just in case I forget while I'm stirring a sauce or what have you with my spatula, and if I forget about it and I leave it leaning on the pan, the high heat temperature spatula can withstand up to 550 degrees. You could put that thing in an oven and it wouldn't melt if it was less than 550 degrees. And on top of that, I would also recommend having a dough scraper. So if you like to make breads or if you like to make, you want to scrape a dough out of a bowl, it's easier to have a little dough scraper. They're plastic, they're bendable. Those are just some of the core things that you definitely need.
What about the cookie sheets? Does it matter what kind you get? I see them very inexpensive at some places, and I see them, with prices through the roof in others. What's the difference?
Sure. No, it is just about the coating. I always go for a nonstick. Then the density of the pan definitely weighs in. If you're doing, if you're doing just straight cookie sheets, I would get the lowest weight, but with a nice simple silicone coating on it. Then you can do stainless steel if you want. Those are a little bit more industrial, but then you'd have to use parchment paper to cook on top of that.
Does it matter? Yeah. Does it matter? A darker coating versus a shiny one? Does it make any difference on how a cookie will bake?
I go more for the darker coating. Shiny coating, I don't necessarily trust, just because it's been polished. So I don't necessarily know what has been used in that, and it's usually a little bit thinner metal. So I always go for a darker baking sheet.
All right, very good. Let's get back to the phone calls. 312-981-7200 to call or text your questions to Chef John. And Jackie, you're on WGN.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I plan on making the pizzelles. I don't know if John is familiar with them. They're the thin
yes.
waffles. Well, I have always made them using anise extract.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I purchased anise oil, and the recipe calls for 2 tablespoons of anise extract. And the last time I made them, I used 2 tablespoons of the anise oil. They were very overpowering.
Very licorice-y.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it was terrible.
Yes.
What would you suggest? Three and a half cups of flour.
So with the anise oil, it's so much more intense. Again, it's like an extract.
Yes.
You want to use, I'm going to say for 3 1/2 cups of flour,
uh-huh.
a half of a teaspoon.
Really?
That should bring the flavor down. And if you need to add more, you can. But uh-huh. I would taste the dough once you've mixed that quarter teaspoon in, because it's so intense. Most of those extract oils last forever on a shelf.
Oh, great. Oh, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Really appreciate it. Have a wonderful holiday.
You too.
When you bake cookies like that, though, that are overpowering with that kind of flavor, isn't that a great story, though, Jackie, that you talk about forever in your family?
Yeah, right. I'm so glad I called. I'm so glad I was listening. Thank you so very much.
Yeah, those kind of kitchen problem stories wind up being fantastic stories
to
tell through
the years.
Yeah,
they sure do.
Have a great Christmas. Merry Christmas to you. Thank you.
Same to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Here's Kurt next on WGN. Hello.
I have a couple items that you might want to put on your always have in the kitchen, or maybe it's a good thing when newlyweds start out. How about a good old-fashioned cast iron skillet?
Definitely.
And pardon me?
Definitely. No, that's a must-have.
And a pressure cooker. That can also double as a big pot for making soups and stuff.
Sure. What do you think the advantage is, John, of a cast iron skillet over Calphalon or aluminum or, you know, whatever the skillet may be?
Yeah, cast iron definitely regulates the heat a heck of a lot better and more even around the entire thing. So, like, for instance, I use my cast iron skillet a lot to make cornbread, and it has even heat. Once the iron in the center, just thinking about where the heat's coming from, it's staying on the bottom of the pot with any other normal pot, but with cast iron, it's going throughout the entire surface of the pot, the sides, bottom, you know, the interior. So it has a much, much more even cooking time, and it just comes out perfect every single time.
Yeah, everybody loves everyone that's got them, and I know that, you know, that's all my grandmother ever used for just about everything. And isn't there
another thing?
There's special care to a cast iron skillet, isn't there, John?
Yes, you don't ever want to wash it per se with soap and water, because you want to leave it what we call seasoned. So with a bit of oil and salt and pepper, I simply take a paper towel and a little bit of salt and rub the interior of my cast iron pot out before I put it away.
Got it. Okay, Kurt, you said one more thing?
Yeah, on the cast iron, I think they're pretty much indestructible. You can't really mess a pan like that up.
That is true.
It's like they'll live forever.
That's very true. They make great weapons, too, in case you ever, you know, call down for that. Merry Christmas to you, Kurt. Thank you for the call. Paula, you're on WGN. Hello.
Hi, good morning. My mom and I used to make rosette cookies with the powdered sugar on top. You take the iron, you put it in the dough, and place it in the oven, in the fryer. And you deep fry these beautiful, beautiful rosettes. My question is, what's the easiest way to get those off that iron?
Because it's going in the oil.
We've struggled with this throughout time, but they're so beautiful.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you use a deep fryer or a fry daddy or something that actually regulates the temperature, or are you just putting it into a pot that has oil
in it?
No, we're using
the old-fashioned frying pans that have the thermostat on it.
Okay.
You pour the oil in there so you can regulate the temperature with that.
Okay. Yeah, that's the only thing really that is going to be the main guide for that. If it's at the proper temperature, once you're putting it in, like 335 to 350 is optimum for frying.
Okay.
And then the other thing you have to think about too is every time you put another one into the fryer, you're lowering the temperature just a little bit.
Oh, okay. So less is more.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
So just, you know, one or two at a time. It's a little bit more painstaking, but they'll come right off of the mold that much quicker.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm going to be having a Three Kings party of all of our international nurses from the Chicago Bilingual Nurse Consortium.
That's great.
And so this is a wonderful, you know, kind of little treat that, you know, nobody really does too much anymore.
Right. Yeah. That's it gives you a lot of respect for grandmas from back in the day, right?
I know.
They would turn out these things like crazy, these incredibly complex and meticulous things that grandmas and moms back in the day worked on all the time.
Oh, the table was filled with these. And one of their most fun things was to fill them up with the powdered sugar and then invite the sisters and the priests over with their whole black outfit.
Love that. Merry Christmas, Paula. Thank you.
Merry Christmas to you, and love your show.
Thank you very much. Here is Anne on WGN. Hello.
Hi, Chef John. My question is about parchment paper. I've fallen in love with it since nothing sticks to it for cookies or even for a bread pan. How do you feel about it?
I love parchment paper. It's my best friend in the kitchen, absolutely, because it doesn't burn. It never burns. It doesn't stick to anything. If you coat it properly, nothing will stick to it. You know, silicone mats are great. They're a little on the pricier side, but nothing beats the price of parchment paper.
And what are you coating that with? Butter?
No, well, it depends on what I'm making. So a little bit of butter, sure, if that's the flavor, you know, the end flavor that I want on the surface of whatever it is I'm cooking or baking. But usually just a pan spray, a pan release spray, or like Pam or something.
Okay, all
well.
Right. And sometimes I'll bake cookies right on there, and they just come right off even without that.
They do. They do.
Do you need to adjust your cooking time, anything, if you're using parchment paper first?
No. No, it's just parchment paper is simply just a barrier in between the metal surface of the pan and the heat from the oven. It work. It just, it's magic.
It's a miracle.
Yep. Yeah,
it's a
great.
Christmas
it
miracle.
Down on meth.
Yeah.
It is. Thank you, guys. Merry Christmas.
Thank you for the call, Mary Ellen. We appreciate it. And, John, thank you, as always, for joining us. We wish you a very, very, very Merry Christmas and one filled with lots of yummy treats.
And to you and yours.
Appreciate your joining us today. It's 1146 WGN.